First, more than three quarters of adults in the U.S. say they've experienced extreme weather in the last 5 years, like floods, wildfires, hurricanes, and heat waves. That's according to a survey by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. In just a bit, we'll find out how you and your family can stay safe when extreme weather strikes. Now we'll take a look at the connection between a changing climate and the risk of extreme weather events. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed storms or droughts or heat waves getting worse over the course of years? How worried are you about severe weather? What questions do you have for our guest about the connection between climate change and extreme weather events? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael Mann is a distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State University. He's the author of the book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. It's available as a paperback with an update to the story. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Are we seeing more extreme weather events of various sorts in recent years?
There's no question. Here in the United States, elsewhere around the Northern Hemisphere, Europe, Asia, in the Southern Hemisphere, Australia, New Zealand, everywhere you look, we're seeing the impacts of climate change now play out in the form of these unprecedented weather extremes. And at some level, the connection is pretty basic. You make the planet warmer, you're going to get more episodes of extreme warmth, more frequent and more intense heat waves. You make the atmosphere warmer, it can hold more moisture. So when it does rain, you get more of it. You get more flooding. But at the same time, that heat dries out soils in the summer in particular, and so you get worse droughts as well. It's not rocket science. You know, there are some basic connections that tell us that this increase that we're seeing in these extreme events, these extreme weather events, is being driven by the warming of the planet, which we know in turn is being driven by our continued burning of fossil fuels and the increase in carbon pollution in the atmosphere.
I know it can be difficult to connect the dots between a particular extreme weather event. If it gets into the 90s for a couple days in Wisconsin, that could just happen by chance. It could be connected to climate change. Can you talk about how, even if you can't make that direct connection, the dice are kind of loaded?
Yeah, and the connection, and there's a whole science now that's been developed over the past couple decades, which is known as detection and attribution. You can basically use a climate model, for example, to look at a counterfactual scenario, say, where we didn't warm up the planet with carbon pollution, and a scenario where we did. And you can look in the simulations, you can look at particular types of weather events that happen in the course of the simulations, and you can tally them. How often does this sort of event happen in the counterfactual climate where we didn't warm up the planet? And how often does it happen in the actual climate simulation where we include the effect of carbon pollution? And when you see that a particular event was extremely unlikely to happen in the counterfactual scenario, but in fact happens regularly in the global warming scenario, then you can draw that connection. You can attribute the event in the same sense that we, for example, attribute deaths from cancer to from lung cancer, for example, to smoking. You know, we can't prove that any particular cigarette led to a case of lung cancer, but when we see that the increase in the prevalence of lung cancer is a factor of 100 or a factor of 1,000, it's such a large increase in the likelihood that we're comfortable in making that connection. We're comfortable in saying that, yes, somebody who smoked their whole life and died of lung cancer, they probably died from the smoking. We can make that same sort of statistical connection now with these extreme weather events. And one last point here, if anything, those attribution studies are conservative. In my view, they actually underestimate the impact that climate change is having on these extreme events, because you're relying on the ability of the models to capture all of the processes in the real world that are behind these events. And we know that there's some subtle processes related, for example, to how warming changes the behavior of the jet stream and gives us these really stagnant high and low pressure systems that give us extreme weather. The models aren't capturing that very well, so they're probably underestimating the impact that carbon pollution and warming is having on these events.
Looking back, the 1970s, when people were first really starting to take climate change seriously, it was a problem kind of down the road. In the 90s, well, our kids, maybe grandkids, we're in it now, right? We're actually feeling human impact from this stuff.
Yeah, it's not subtle anymore. It's no longer about, you know, polar bears up in the Arctic decades from now. It's about these devastating extreme weather events that we are seeing play out in real time in Wisconsin, back here in Pennsylvania, and around the world. The bad news is that it's gotten bad enough that we can see the impacts playing out in real time. That's sort of, you know, the tip of the iceberg. And it tells you how much worse things can get if we fail to act now, if we fail to reduce carbon emissions and stabilize the temperature of the planet.
Talking to Michael Mann from Penn State University, climate scientist there, author of the book, The New Climate War, looking at the connection between climate change and extreme weather events. Let's go to a caller at 800-642-1234. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I've been gardening for over 40 years, and I think that anyone that farms or is in touch with their environment would notice the changes. We've had more erratic frost dates early and late, and the autumn, the spring and the autumn seems to have the climate in those areas have seemed to change. I think the rainfalls, you know, we used to have like rainy days. That's really rare these days to have like a rainy day, or we have someone will get like 6 inches of rain, you know, 10 miles from here, and we didn't get anything. I mean, there's all sorts of events that are happening, like
I got you, Willem. We're getting some background noise there, but point taken, Michael. Can you talk about the impact on agriculture, whether it's somebody gardening at home like Willem or, you know, a drought in some of the biggest vegetable and fruit producing areas of the country in California?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I actually have some colleagues who are at the University of Wisconsin-Madison who actually specialize in looking at the impact of climate change, for example, on farming and agriculture in the state of Wisconsin. And there's a whole outreach component where scientists actually work with, you know, farmers and ranchers who are dealing with these impacts. And it's sort of interesting because these folks tend to be sort of politically conservative. They tend to be among the groups least likely to actually, you know, accept the science of climate change. And yet they know that something is happening. That's what you hear from these stories. In Wisconsin, here in Pennsylvania, where I have colleagues who sort of do the same sort of outreach and extension to farmers and here in the state of Pennsylvania, you know, it's these people are directly in touch with their environment. Their livelihood depends on their ability to cope with the environment, with, you know, the weather, with these environmental changes, and so they're very sensitive to the changes that are impacting them. And, you know, they see it happening. And so it's absolutely the case that some of the, you know, most interesting evidence of how climate change is impacting us now actually comes from these sorts of folks, farmers and ranchers in Texas, for example, where they lost 25% of their cattle during the unprecedented 2010 the drought in Texas and Oklahoma. I mean, they're seeing these impacts. It's impacting their livelihood. And that's actually sort of changing public opinion a little bit. You're seeing some of these, again, people from sort of a demographics that aren't necessarily sort of, you know, the most concerned generally about climate change. They're being forced to become concerned about it because it's impacting them.
People might hear the news that climate change is here now, it's affecting us, and think, well, all right, it's too late, so we can't do anything about it. Do our decisions now make a difference in the years to come?
Yeah, and that's really important because there is this growing sort of sense of doomism. You know, people who aren't climate change deniers, and they're just the opposite. They're extremely concerned. But in fact, they're so concerned that they have sort of fallen into this pit of despair where they're convinced that we can't do anything about the problem anymore. Ironically, that potentially leads them down the same path of disengagement and inaction as outright denial of the problem. So it's really important that, you know, when we friends and family members and colleagues who we see sort of falling into this sort of climate doomism, to make sure they understand that we can actually prevent things from getting worse. And the science actually, you know, supports that pretty strongly. The science, you know, tells us that, you know, if we stop carbon pollution into the atmosphere, the temperature of the planet stabilizes pretty quickly. And so there's a direct and immediate impact of our effort to reduce carbon emissions. If we act now, we can prevent the planet from crossing the threshold of 1.5 Celsius, 3 degrees Fahrenheit, where we'll start to see the worst impacts. But there's urgency as well. There's agency. We can make a difference, but there is urgency. We have to bring those carbon emissions down by about 50% within the next decade if we are to keep warming below that dangerous level.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That's Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State University. We talked with him about the connection between climate change and extreme weather events. Up next, we'll get advice from the state's Emergency Management Department on preparing for extreme weather. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you faced any storm damage yet this year? Are you seeing changes? Do you have questions for the state's Emergency Management Department about how to prepare for extreme weather? Are there things you've done to protect your home, your family, your business, your farm from different kinds of weather changes? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up that conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about severe weather. Wisconsin averages 23 tornadoes a year. Last year, more than 40 touched down. Our next guest tells us how to prepare for various kinds of severe weather. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you and your family have a storm preparedness plan? What does that look like? Have you put it into action this year? Do you have questions for our guest about how to prepare for different kinds of weather and natural disasters? Have you been through a big one in your community? What happened in the aftermath? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Andrew Beckett is a public information officer with Wisconsin Emergency Management. He also runs the state's Ready Wisconsin campaign, which encourages the public to be prepared for emergencies and disasters. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into particular kinds of extreme weather events, are there some general rules you'd suggest to people to prepare for different manners of disaster?
Well, the first thing that we really encourage everyone is to be weather aware. And really what that means is making sure that you have multiple ways to receive information about what the weather is going to be for that day, but as also when severe weather alerts are issued for your area. That includes local media, NOAA weather radios, and having wireless emergency alerts enabled on your smartphone if you have one.
Let's start with heat waves. They can be, they're one of the most lethal kinds of weather-related disasters in the country, but they're not as dramatic. I think people don't necessarily pay attention to them as much. What kind of things do you want to make sure people are paying attention to?
Well, first and foremost, it's knowing the signs that your body's telling you that you're getting too hot. Being able to identify things like heat stroke or heat exhaustion, you know, that cold, clammy skin, or feeling overheated itself, feeling weak, nauseous, dizzy. Those kinds of things are a sign that, you know, you need to get to a cooler area and maybe even seek medical attention if you're really feeling the ill effects, and learning how to spot those signs in others as well. I mean, those are really the critical parts to protecting yourself during the hottest weather, in addition to making sure you're doing things like being hydrated, seeking shady areas, and trying not to be outdoors in direct sunlight during the hottest parts of the day.
I remember from the big Chicago heat wave, was that back in the 90s? The advice really came out after that: check in on vulnerable people, seniors and others, especially if you know they don't have AC. Can you talk about the importance of being in touch with each other during an event like that?
Really, a communications plan is essential when it comes to any sorts of severe weather. You want to make sure that you have that list of contacts for individuals that you can seek help from in the event that you need it, but also to check in on them when a storm moves through the area or a heat event, making sure that you're checking in, especially on elderly neighbors or those who have, you know, disabilities or difficulty getting around on their own and may not have access to something that could be crucial in those kinds of conditions. Making sure you're checking in on them regularly, and if they need assistance, finding a way to get them that help.
Then, of course, tornadoes. I mean, I've lived my whole life in the Midwest, so I feel like most of us know what we need to know, but remind us what we do in cases of tornado watches, tornado warnings.
A watch is when the conditions are right for those tornadoes to develop. And really, that's just a sign that you need to be aware of that potential. But when that warning is issued for your area, you know, that is an indication that there is a threat directly affecting you and that you need to take action. And really, that first thing is, you know, get to a sturdy shelter, whether that be a basement or a ground floor interior room of a built home. You know, those are the areas that you should really be going to seek shelter. The main goal is to put as much distance between you and the outside as possible, because really it's that flying debris that's often kicked up by those strong winds that poses the greatest risk to people.
And then I saw earlier this week was an awareness day for lightning safety. People don't think about it. Again, we're in the Midwest. This is a risk.
Absolutely. You know, lightning can strike miles away from a storm itself. And it's really important to pay attention. If you see that lightning or hear thunder, you know, it's a sign that you could be at risk and that you need to seek shelter indoors, you know, away from trees. Really, there's not any safe place outside. Even a shelter at a park is not a safe place to be from lightning. You really want to get into an enclosed space in order to protect yourself.
And finally, flooding. We've already had some tragic deaths related to flooding in the state this year. Couple key pointers.
Really, the first and foremost thing is stay out of floodwaters. You know, don't drive through them. Don't walk through them. It really only takes a few inches of moving water to knock a person over and potentially carry them away. You know, less than a foot of water can carry most small vehicles away. So it's important to just stay out of the water when you encounter it during a flooding situation. You don't know what the surface of the road is going to look like beneath the surface of that water. And a road that you drove across 20 minutes ago may have crumbled beneath, and you could easily find yourself in a dangerous situation quickly.
Talking to Andrew Beckett with Wisconsin Emergency Management, looking at extreme weather events, how to be ready for them. Now, bigger picture, Andrew, when a tornado, say, hits a community or a major flood, can you talk about the reaction to that disaster, the first steps?
Well, really, the first steps is to make sure that everybody's okay and that they've gotten out safely and are not in immediate danger or have any serious injuries. Afterwards, you know, you want to make sure that you are documenting any damage that was done to your home, contacting local authorities if there is a risk on your property, you know, a tree that's hanging down and might potentially injure somebody if it falls, or utility lines that might be down. You don't want to approach them, but you want to make sure you contact your utility provider with that information so that they can get out there and address the problem as quickly as possible. And, you know, you want to make sure that you are identifying what you need to do in order to help get your life back on track, whether that's contacting your insurance provider, finding out what they need in order to help try and help repair that damage. You know, those are the steps that are really important in the immediate aftermath so that you can work on your recovery as quick as possible.
And you mentioned the insurance company, and I know in disasters around the country, sometimes people are surprised at the wrong moment about what insurance does and doesn't cover when it comes to disasters. What kind of things should people be thinking about, you know, before that disaster strikes?
It's important to make sure you know what your policy covers and then identify what needs to be done with that policy in order to make sure that you have coverage for those things that you may not have thought about. You know, most private homeowners insurance policies do not cover flooding. You either need to purchase flood insurance or maybe even get a rider on your existing policy in order to address any issues that you might see as a result of floodwaters. You know, those are the kind of things that's important to find out about in advance, because it does take time for insurance coverage to take effect. So really talk to your insurance agent, identify what your policy does and does not cover, and identify how you can go about getting your policy expanded potentially if you feel it's needed.
Now, what does it mean when a governor of Wisconsin declares a state of emergency following some kind of natural disaster?
Well, a state of emergency is really a move that is intended to help mobilize state resources if they're requested, whether that be, you know, assistance with debris removal, potentially bringing in the National Guard for assistance. I mean, really, that is a step taken in order to help get the process moving for the deployment of resources quickly if they're requested.
What kind of resources, Andrew, do you point people toward to be ready for natural disasters in the state?
Well, our website, the Ready Wisconsin website, readywisconsin.wi.gov, has a wealth of information on there for the different kinds of threats that exist in the state, but also the things that people can do in order to make their own home emergency kit and make that plan for what to do when they're faced with different types of disasters.
What should be in our home emergency kit?
Home emergency kit should include a basic 72-hour supply of food and water, because it may take time for assistance to get there. Things like battery-operated flashlights, a hand-crank weather radio is a great idea. And then in first aid supplies and other essentials that you might need in the immediate aftermath of an incident.
And do you recommend people kind of review their kits? I know with flashlights in particular, they don't last forever.
Absolutely. Every year is really a good idea to kind of go through those kits and check those expiration dates. Batteries, even non-perishable food sometimes does have a bit of a shelf life, and you may want to consider replacing canned goods every few years. You know, those are the kind of things that should be checked regularly, especially when it comes to things like first aid kits. You don't want to have old medications or even antibiotic or first aid supplies that have gone past their expiration date for when you really need them.
Andrew, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Andrew Beckett is a public information officer with Wisconsin Emergency Management. He joined us today to talk about what happens after a natural disaster strikes and how you can prepare for storms and other extreme weather events this summer.